Hey folks, my name is Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table is a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is the podcast edit of something that we do together in person. We just call it the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with you in the hope that it can be a positive contribution and a catalyst for your own exploration, or perhaps something that you share with somebody else you know is exploring what they believe to support and encourage them. In our experience, exploring what you believe can be hard work, exciting, encouraging, but also challenging. And we don't think that anyone should have to do that alone. On a perhaps more personal note, I don't believe that we do it best alone. I think we do it best together with others. We're able to do this work because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond the local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com under the Giving tab. Thanks for dropping by. Welcome to the Talky Bit. So in this series, we're in the home stretch. I once read an interesting article about motor vehicle statistics, which said that the majority of accidents, motor vehicle accidents, happen within a couple of miles of what the driver would regard as home. Now, anyway, I've ever worked with who is good with data. And I do the intuitive part of data, not the math part of data, but I've got to work with people who are really great at both. And, or even folks, some of you, you know, you have this memory, maybe not a pleasant one, but of having to be required to take that dreaded undergrad course that has stats somewhere in the course description. Anyway, anybody who's sort of ever had to work with data and the way those things work might recognize in a statement like that that it would be difficult to establish a defensible causal relationship in that data. Because why is that the case? So we might be able to measure that. We might know that that's statistically true. Majority of motor vehicle accidents happen within a couple of miles of home. Why? Maybe it's because when we get closer to home, we let our guard down a little bit. Maybe it's because most of us never drive more than a few miles from home. So that's where all the accidents would happen, if you measured it that way. A perhaps related statistic is the measurable fact that more high altitude climbers die on the descent than on the ascent, usually because they haven't adequately accounted for how much energy the descent requires or how much they've expended on the climb up. I mean, the way down should be easier, right? It's gravity assisted. How hard could this be? All to say, this notion of the home stretch isn't always coasting. Sometimes the home stretch is difficult and dangerous. And when it comes to turning the corner on experiences like religious trauma, RTSs, we've been referring to it, that is often the case. The home stretch isn't necessarily easier. And I really wrestled with, when I wrote that sentence, I kind of stopped and checked in with myself and I was like, why, Tim, why do you feel apologetic writing that? Like, why do you feel reluctant to say that in this context where I feel like I've got so much permission to speculate about things and to explore things? And as far as I could tell when I stopped to think about it a bit, there are a few factors. One significant factor is that the narratives that I grew up around that had to do with what was often called healing, or perhaps more often in my formative environments, freedom, that those narrative structures often featured outside divine intervention. As in, believe the right things and God's going to set you free from, you know, insert problem here, right? And I'm not going to ask for any kind of show of hands, but if I was a betting man, I would wager good money that at least a few of us can remember confessing the same sin more than once, and then wondering why the freedom that was supposed to come with the confession didn't stick. And when that didn't work, then there's this little tide of questions that flow into that vacuum. Maybe I didn't do it right. Maybe I'm broken in a way that God can't fix. Maybe I'm broken in a way that God won't fix. Maybe, and I think this is a classic, maybe I just don't have enough faith. I didn't believe hard enough, or I didn't believe right enough. I feel like I personally really parted ways with that theology when people that were close to me lost a child and somebody in their faith community offered that as the reason why their prayers for healing were not answered. I was like, not only is that not good thinking, that's just bloody cruel.
And that's how I recall feeling about it at the time. And you know, point of departure, right? In that list of why doesn't this work questions, the one that I don't remember ever showing up was maybe this system of belief is broken. Or maybe I should amend that in terms of my memory. I can remember some conversations with thoughtful friends who submitted that possibility, but I wasn't ready to hear it. So even though I could acknowledge that critique intellectually, the rest of me, including my body, although I couldn't have articulated that at that point in my life, couldn't feel the merit of what they were saying or entertain what might be involved in engaging with it as a whole person. I couldn't get there. So as we get into this part of the series, I want to clarify a couple of things. And the first is that what we'll be exploring in this part of the series is probably better thought of as recovery rather than healing. Could just be playing around with words here, but I'll unpack that a little bit. The second is that the journey of recovery in these realms, like the harmful experiences in them, vary a great deal. So when I sit down to decide what I'll include or leave out of a talkie bit on something like this, I know from the beginning that there's no way to offer something that's going to connect with everyone's experience. So I would simply say, watch for what's for you. What I'm going to share is grounded in good research, as well as the stories of lots of survivors. And if this is a realm of experience that you or someone you know is in, then there may well be something there that's helpful. That would be my hope, if only by way of informing our imagination and our empathy about the possibilities, even if this isn't necessarily our story. So, to the first point, that this is an exploration of recovery rather than healing. Part of what I'm after with that distinction is trying to move us away from what I would call magical thinking. One of the most important ideas to me personally in recent years in terms of my own way of navigating the world has been coming to understand that I don't have to believe what I think. Right. Yeah. That for me too, that was a hmm. As soon as I zoomed out from it, I was like, oh, of course. That's what it means when you change your mind. Right? But I hadn't thought of it that way in terms of behavior until I heard someone talk about it that way and in a way that called the reflection out of me. I don't have to believe what I think. I've long believed, way before I kind of hit that little intersection, I've long believed and accepted that my perspective as a human is limited. That the way I see and experience the world is what I have to work with, but that perception of the world leaves out far more than it includes. And that's true even if I want to be open-minded and open-hearted. I'm a human, which from my perspective automatically means that I'm a limited perceiver. I'm a limited knower. That's how my brain works, and yours too. And it's actually part of how we survive the world. It's not an unimportant feature of our humanness. Even if we could perceive everything, we would collapse under the weight of it. And that's one of the reasons I would submit to you why anxiety is on the rise. In easily, broadly measurable ways. We've got access to more information than we have the internal, or I would say perhaps even communal tools to carry without harm. Our humanness is overwhelmed. And when I look at geopolitics, I would say our collective humanness actually is suffering under many things, including that. The idea that there is some external force that could zap that reality about our humanness away, that's what I mean by magical thinking. That could absolutize something in our lives. I don't find that a tenable idea. As an extension of that, if I've been formed around some of those kinds of ideas, I might have ways of thinking, I might have patterns of thought that shouldn't be believed, or that I need to change if I'm going to recover from the harm that those patterns of thought have done and can continue to do. So the word patterns is important in that sentence, all right? Because the way our brains work, I'm sure I must have mentioned this particular study to this community before, but in case I haven't, it's one of my favorites. This particular study measured what our brains process in bits per second. And in the study, the big benchmark was that our brains process about 12 million bits of information per second. The interesting question to me is how many of those are processed by our conscious mind? Anybody care to take a swipe at that number? of the 12 million per second, how many do you think our conscious mind processes?
10.
It's remarkably low. Yeah. 40 is the number that that study featured, right? 40 of 12 million. So our subconscious is processing 11,999,960 of those bits. And the way that it processes them is sort of, they've got three, our brain has three options when we have an experience, a stimulus, or something comes in through our perception. Our brain can either, our subconscious can either file it in a familiar file. It's like, this is related to that. It belongs there. Or this is irrelevant. We should ignore it. Or this doesn't fit a file I already have. I need to send it to the front office for processing. But the front office can only handle 40 of 12 million bits. So it gets overwhelmed pretty fast. So in terms of the neurobiology of this, how our brains actually work, and as well how our minds work, there's some real limitations here. That's another way of talking about limitations to our patterns of thought. 11,999,960 of the bits we're processing every second are handled by a pattern, not by conscious consideration. It's not a bad thing. It's how we survive the world, but we just need to know it, right? We need to be aware of it. We can change what we think. We don't have to believe what we think. A lot of what we think is subconscious. This is what a good therapist does, by the way, is they take you, if you imagine the filing room with all those 11,900 its files in there, they take you into the file room and they help you dig around and find the things that are misfiled and refile them, right? That's to me, that's my favorite metaphor for that part of recovery. It's like, oh, this doesn't need to mean that anymore. It meant that then, perhaps, or this got misfiled right from the beginning because of an association or because of a vulnerability or because of a not fully formed brain or mind. It's not unusual, right? I don't have to believe what I think. Patterns of thought can be changed, and so can the beliefs that they underpin. Because that's the way that works. Stimulus, belief, action, or consequence. That's the flow behaviorally. More on that in a bit. So to try to sum some of that up, anyone that I know or have read or have heard talking about the road to recovery around RTS or around any kind of recovery will say that it's a lot of work. It's not a switch that we flick. It's not a prayer that we pray. It's not a ritual we go through. I've often also, most often, heard those voices say it's worth it. Absolutely, it's worth it. But a lot of ongoing effort is required. To the second idea there, that this journey is different for everyone, I'm just going to add this. That idea that this journey of recovery is different for everyone as regards religious trauma and religious trauma syndrome, I think that logically follows on the fact that trauma, for all of its discernible common features, is a uniquely personal experience. So it's reasonable to understand that recovery would be a uniquely personal experience as well. I'll speak to the commonalities of this as well as I can, but we should always put that information about commonalities through what I just pointed out. This is a unique journey. If we don't, I think we're especially vulnerable to getting tossed back into that whole what's wrong with me when what worked for X isn't working for me, right? And this is a thing that compressed storytelling does not help with, right? This is when you watch the testimonial in the reel or the short or the post. It's like, I was really struggling with this and then I found this magic process and now I'm better. Like, that's a really short, and how lovely. That's a pretty short version of what might be a very long story, right? And there's a built-in assumption that maybe if we get thing X as well, especially if marketing's involved here, if we could just have that product or that method, we could have that kind of a compressed experience of recovery. The same size as the advertisement. And that's not how it works. All right, on to some of the commonalities. First of all, in very general terms, I think an important question is, what might we expect the stages of recovery from trauma in general, and more particularly religious trauma, to look like? And we touched on this last week when I mentioned Peter Levine's outline for healing from trauma in general. In Levine's model, that includes three stages, as I outlined them then: leaving the environment that's harmful, establishing safety, and releasing emotions. Those are sort of the three big chunks. Marlene Winnell's work, which is focused directly on religious trauma syndrome, she's sort of the progenitor, the first big voice in this conversation in terms of research. She outlines recovery this way from religious trauma: separation, confusion, avoidance, feeling, and rebuilding. Those first three just don't sound that pleasant, do they? Like, Feeling, well, feeling can be quite the mixed bag, right? But rebuilding, that sounds awesome. Separation, confusion, and avoidance as steps in recovery might not be intuitive or even initially especially appealing. Now, with ideas like the stages of grief, Kubler-Ross's sort of famous model, which keeps growing in terms of how many stages there are, like lots of these models. But like stages of grief, those sorts of outlines of process can be both really helpful. Many of us who've processed grief have certainly found Kubler-Ross's thinking about it helpful. They can also be misleading. And what I mean by that is that they can be helpful in the sense that they can support us in understanding what we're going through, what we're working at, and knowing that what we're going through and working at is something that lots of folks are working through as well. That this is a shared experience as well as a uniquely personal one. And just that knowledge can be invaluable, not least of all in the moments where we experience self-doubt or where other people call our journey into question. Knowing that this is something we have in common with others is very, very powerful piece of the recovery puzzle. It can also provide some support when what's going through our minds might be questions like, is this just me? Is this all in my head? Am I wrong? Am I crazy? Those kind of questions. And at the very least, if we're asking ourselves those kinds of questions and the answer to any of them is yes, then at the very least, we know that we've got company. And for us as human herd animals, that's really important information. Knowing that we're not alone is very, very important. However, an outline like that can also be less helpful if we think it's something that we'll experience as a tidy linear pathway with sequential steps over ground that only has to be traversed once and then never revisited. As with grief, recovery from trauma, from religious trauma, isn't usually orderly and tidy and linear. So with that in mind, let's consider just for a moment how those two models might overlap. So when we're recovering from a harmful religious past, leaving the environment and establishing safety, the first two stages of Levine's model, those span the same sort of human experiences of recovery as separation, confusion, and avoidance do in Winnell's model. Those two overlap. So Levine would say the first two stages of his three are leaving the environment and establishing safety. Winnell would say the first three stages of her five are separation, confusion, and avoidance. They cover the same kind of ground. And it's also important to note that most often these stages are the precursors to arriving at the stage of feeling or releasing emotions and rebuilding. And we've talked about that in previous weeks about how important releasing the emotion that got stuck in the traumatic moment or experience is what turns PTSD into sort of small-t trauma and opens the door to moving forward and all of that. So remembering that a recovery phase like separation might look different for everyone, there are some observable themes. And I'm going to reference a fairly well-known contemporary Christian mystic here, Richard Rohr. And Rohr says that enlightenment, by which we mean in this context the act of gaining understanding or knowledge, so he would say that that experience or act of gaining knowledge or understanding requires separation, which almost always comes on the heels of either great love or great suffering. So this is an interesting, to me at least, this is a very interesting framework for the notion of learning something that we didn't know before, gaining understanding or knowledge. So for example, it's not that unusual a story for someone to reconsider their beliefs because they come to care deeply for a person who doesn't share their beliefs. We actually get to know someone who doesn't believe what we believe, and we love them. Now what? Right? Or we get a new neighbor who challenges our worldview of some other that we have in our head in terms of human difference. One of the consistent reasons over the years that people show up at the table is because their thinking is changing. And one of the themes over and over again is because people show up here because their thinking or their beliefs about gender and sexuality have changed because they've gotten to know someone whose gender identity, which they were taught was a sin, no longer makes sense to them. So they go looking for a community where they don't have to swim upstream in that dissonance in order to be part of the community. This is not an unusual theme in terms of when I ask people, how did you find us and why did you look? It's because of this. And that is without considering members of the LGBTQ plus community itself or Indigenous people or people of color or women in general as a gender group. all groups that I name in that particular sentence because they've been uniquely, recognizably vilified and marginalized by fundamentalist Christianity and uniquely by white fundamentalist evangelical Christianity. Oh, I left the word male out of that little collection, but it belongs there. So experiences that bring us face to face with those kinds of pain points are often the catalysts for a change in thinking, a change in beliefs, an awareness of the connection between these sorts of beliefs and our own suffering and the need for change. That's often that catalyst that Rohrer is talking about. I won't get into the details of this in part because of what we already considered about how these experiences are different for each person, but it's not unusual for that great suffering part to show up in our lived experience as signals from our bodies that something needs to change. We're stressed, but it's not eustress, it's distress. And our bodies try to get our attention about that. However, when we're taught, and in these harmful systems that we've been examining, this is one of the things that is often taught. When we're taught that our inner voice cannot be trusted, it's hard for us to know how to listen to and trust our bodies telling us what they need, let alone act on it. There's a gap. There's a disconnect. As an additional note, if the voice that we have been taught we should trust is the voice of an angry male deity, we might find listening to our own inner voice uniquely challenging if we don't identify as male, or if that voice might only be discernible to us, even in ourselves, when it's the voice of anger. And I would say that that is one of the reasons, broad brushing here, but that is one of the reasons why when, and there's a big stereotype here, but it's measurable in the data. When people who identify as male are trying to get in touch with their feelings, with their emotions, often that's a story where in the early going, the only emotion that they can identify is anger. It's the only emotional tool that they've been allowed to become good at, and they try to use it for everything. Because that's the one that they've got their hands on. That's the one that they can grasp. That's the tool they have. Why? Well, even if you didn't grow up around fundamentalist teachings about a pissed off God who was so mad that he killed his own kid, like even if you didn't kind of grow up in that story, the notion that God is angry and needs to be pacified or placated or something needs to get in the way to keep us from being harmed by that deity because they're angry, that permissions us in imitating our God to be angry. Right? And not just about things about which anger is not the villain here as a feeling. Anger is an emotion. Emotions are neutral. We don't experience them neutrally, but they just are. They're like gravity. It's what we do with the anger. Where's the anger directed? What is the anger in response to? We need anger, but we sure need a lot of other emotions too. We need more tools than just a hammer. It comes back to that outline once again. We're still talking about the first of those first three stages, separation, confusion, and avoidance. We've just been talking about what prompts separation. Great love, great suffering. What about confusion and avoidance? It can be confusing to begin to reconsider teachings that have guided our meaning making, especially when considering them assails the meaning that we've made. It's disconcerting, to put it mildly, to watch what we were told were essential truths crumble in the light of logic, reason, history, science, even in the light of other religious perspectives or systems of belief. That can really shake us up. It's really hard work to discover that frameworks that we have depended on are, in the end, not infallible, not eternal, not immutable. They're changeable. That in itself rocks the boat pretty hard. And our meaning-making frameworks can take a real beating in this process. So, among other things, we need to be patient with ourselves because this dance of confusion and avoidance is way more circular than it is linear. And this idea might sound just categorically objectionable to some of us who are more action-oriented, but it does just need to take the time that it needs. This is not a thing we can actually force effectively. That can be an incredibly frustrating truth to come to terms with for all kinds of reasons. When you consider that a process like this can take us through a reconsideration of, this is not an exhaustive list, but it can take us through a reconsideration of all of our notions of personhood, what does it mean to be a human, all of our ideas about purpose, our ideas about relationship to other people, how we measure those, how we enact those, our explanations about the world, our interpretations of the past, our expectations for the future, directions about how to feel, think, make decisions, lead our lives. All that stuff gets hauled in, out of the shadows of our subconscious and put on the table for consideration when we get into this process. So it's hardly a surprise that the second of those first three stages is confusion. This is confusing stuff, potentially. When we've been standing on something we were taught was certain, and even just the certitude of it gets stripped away, it makes sense that avoidance would follow right behind. Because the reality of what has been lost can simply be too much to handle, and we have to turn away to regroup before we can circle back. I've had more than one conversation with people who were like, why do I feel sad about letting go of a concept of God that has caused me harm? Why does that feel like a loss? Shouldn't it just be like, party, you know, like I kicked the monster out of the house because I had a relationship with the monster. I was counting on them. That's how I was navigating the world. And now I can't navigate that way anymore. That's confusing. Even if I believe, even if I think that this needs to happen. Which in turn can make it hard to feel the emotions that need to be felt in order for recovery to move forward. Because every model that I know of for recovery from trauma stops at that station. We have to feel the feelings we weren't allowed to or enabled to feel in the moment. That's why the trauma is trauma, because it got stuck there instead of the energy of those feelings being processed and expelled. It's still in our bodies, going in circles. I'm going to return to that in a moment, but as what I think for this community is an important aside, when we look at what recovery might look like through this kind of a lens, through this kind of process, it's, to me at least, it feels pretty obvious that not trying to do this alone is very important. It's not unusual for people in this process to experience things like the loss of community, the loss of or shift profound change of relationships, shared structures for human interaction and experience, and the sense of security that can come from being with other people who share our beliefs. Most of us, if we've changed a belief or left a community that held a certain set of beliefs that we could no longer entertain or be well in, or that we recognized were actively harming us, we might still be leaving a community that is precious to us, that grounds us, that surrounded us, that gave us a sense of being more able to navigate the world. We can experience a profound sense in processes like this of being alone in the world, not just in terms of no longer being able to reliably locate the divine in our narrative, disconcerting enough, but not being able to know which humans we can trust and connect with. More nuanced way to think about that is, which humans can we trust with what? Because trust is not a binary. It's not just, I trust you, I don't trust you. It's, I trust you with this, but I don't trust you with this. All the nuances of that. This is one of the central reasons, folks, why this community exists. We don't have a lot of we believe statements. In fact, we only really have one that we articulate in that kind of a we believe framework, and that is the belief that no one should have to explore what they believe alone. We might, and others might, choose to explore that alone. But we shouldn't have to explore that alone. It's a choice. Being supported in the process of experiencing separation, confusion, avoidance, and of finding ourselves sometimes sort of stuck in spin in the midst of these stages benefits from support. Now, sometimes we need supports that are more specific and focused than those provided by just a general community. And when it comes to recovery from something like religious trauma syndrome, those can be challenging to locate. Because helping professionals who know the language of the systems and the true severity of the belief experience, but who aren't dismissive about the trauma or inclined to point their clients back to a place of belief, not easily found. There's a small group of specialists in this niche, which is yet another reason why finding a community of support is so important. That can be quite a journey in itself, if that's something that we're looking for. All right, let me wrap this up by at least gesturing toward the next stage in the process. We touched on this last week. We're going to dig into it more the next time we're in this series. We'll dig into the next stage in the process a bit more, but I want to at least make a note of it before we finish up today. When we start to make some progress in these early stages of recovery, from religious trauma or related syndromes. One of the things that happens is that we start to feel the emotions we were taught not to feel. I talked about being permission to feel anger. Some of us have been taught that feeling that's a problem, right? It's a sin to be angry. You're supposed to forgive. You're supposed to move on. Let God deal with it. Hand it over to a divine judge, et cetera, et cetera. Just tamp that emotion down. So there's a range there too, right? But we may start to recognize when we move into this process that our minds and our bodies have been in conflict with one another, that we've felt the need for repentance and shame, for example, about things for which there is not necessarily any need for repentance or shame. We might experience the dissonance of changing our mind about a belief, but having our bodies still have feelings rooted in the former belief. I once heard someone describe leaving an authoritarian belief system as being like a divorce and a death at the same time. As you might expect from an image like that, the grief that comes with it can be very complex, not least of all because those around us, and we ourselves, might not be able to readily point to the source of our grief. The loss is complex enough that it's hard to name. We know there's a loss. We know there's grief, but pinning it to something can just be like, where do I go next? Sometimes that also means that the further away we get from some of the sources of those beliefs that we're trying to separate from, the more pressure we might put on ourselves to, you know, to move on. And when we don't feel like we're moving on very successfully, those shame voices, those judgment voices are just waiting right there in the wings to go, that's because you shouldn't, or that's because you're not doing it right, or that's because you don't have enough faith, or because you're believing wrong, or all the same messages that did the harm in the first place. But, as we noted last week, our bodies and minds are connected. They speak the same language. And just because our brains dismiss a teaching or an idea doesn't mean that our bodies don't still need to heal from the physiological trauma that's brought on by those ideas. We might believe X, but still feel Y. At the risk of leaving this on a profoundly unsatisfying note, an unresolved chord for the musicians in our midst, where these first three stages lead us is toward feelings, toward reconnecting our bodies and our minds in ways that speak to the disconnects caused by trauma. And that tends to lead us into the terrain of grief, often both preceded by and accompanied by anger. And so that's where we're going to pick things up next time we're in the series, is actually on that theme of anger, which we introduced today but didn't really explore that much. And until then, what I would want to add is simply a reminder of something that we all know. And that is, we need to remember in all of this that we don't have to do this exploring alone. Peace.